the Hujjat is going to be the Prophet, peace be upon him. It's going to be where, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can say to us then, you know, I sent you this perfect Prophet, and, you know, I told you to follow his example, and he did everything perfectly the way he was supposed to.
Right. And what did you go wrong?
And what did you do? Now, it's interesting, because you would think that, you know, that which is the most beloved of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that being, you know, and he is, obviously the Prophet is the most beloved. And then you have ayahs in the Quran, which are very interesting, which say things like, you know, this is the word from Allah, this is, you know, brought down revelation from Allah, mm-hmm. from God, brought down. And if he had not conveyed it correctly, what does it say in the Quran? It says we would have cut off his aorta. Aorta is that main vein in the body, okay? Anybody who knows a little anatomy, that's right. Like the major vein in your body, which if it's cut, that's it, you're dead.
It, right.
There's no turning back. So here it is, God saying in his revelation, saying, you know, to about his beloved, saying that if he hadn't done this correctly, I would have killed him. And then there, it's interesting, the next ayah is, and none of you could have done anything about it. Okay, it's pretty heavy.
Enough pressure, I think.
Right, so the point is that it's about that perfect message from the perfect God being conveyed by the perfect person.
May we all be worthy enough to follow the
Inshallah.
True Prophet of Islam and his religion. Thanks again for joining us. Until next time. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
In mid-February, a man immensely influential in shaping Islamic thoughts and teachings in Indonesia died of the coronavirus. Social media pages were immediately flooded with condolences coming from across the socio-political spectrum, from activists to academics, to politicians and celebrities, to pay tribute to a religious scholar who had devoted his life to love, knowledge, and the promotion of moderation. Professor Jalaluddin Rahmat, better known by his nickname, Kang Jalal. Jalaluddin was born in Bandung in 1949 to an educated Muslim family. Despite his religious family background, Jalaluddin only received religious education until he graduated from elementary school. The library of Dutch residences, the remnant of the Dutch colony in the country, was one of the places the young Jalaluddin spent his time reading the works of great philosophers and thinkers such as Spinoza and Nietzsche. Jalaluddin attended the Pajar Joran University and earned a degree in mass communications and began teaching there as a lecturer after graduation. He won a scholarship from Iowa State University, where he studied communications and psychology. Jalaluddin graduated with honors from the university in 1981 before returning to Indonesia. When he got home, Jalal ad-Din wrote a book on the psychology of communication, designed the curriculum for his faculty in the Pajajaran University, and gave lectures on various subjects such as Indonesia's political system, ethics and Islam, which drew the attention of university students. In the meantime, Professor Rahmat went on an intellectual journey to the holy city of Qom, Iran, where he studied Irfan, or Islamic mysticism, as well as Islamic philosophy. Kang Jalal's interest in Irfan and Sufism began during a conference in Colombia back in 1984, where he met with a group of Iranian thinkers. The meeting and ensuing conversations eventually encouraged him to go to Iran, the birthplace of many great Sufis such as Imam Ghazali, Rumi, Attar Naishaburi, and Bayazid Bastami, classic figures known for their pluralistic tendencies, by which followers of different sects and religions could coexist peacefully. By the time he came back home from Iran, Jalal's way of thinking had already become even more influenced by Islamic Iranian mysticism, which promotes moderation and tolerance. At this point, many of his books on Sufism were written, such as Sufi Reformation, 1998, Reaching Divine Love, Sufi Enlightenment, 2000, The Road to Allah, 2007, The Way of Grace, Knocking on the Door of God, 2011, and so on. Jalal pursued his education in Australia, where he received his PhD in political science from the Australian National University. Upon arriving home, he began teaching various courses such as communications, philosophy of science, and mysticism at the country's most prestigious universities and institutes. Kang Jalal's mastery of several foreign languages besides English and Arabic, such as German, Dutch, French, and Persian, made him able to access a wide range of thinkers in their own native languages, which in turn made his writings not only fresh and new, but also deep and sharp. Two of his books, Alternative Islam, 1986, and Actual Islam, 1991, which he wrote after his return from the United States, are widely read books by Muslim activists of all stripes. The mysticism developed by Kang Jalal, which drew upon the ideas of Sufi figures, was in fact an attempt to form a new civil society order where different sects and religions could peacefully interact with each other under the umbrella of religious pluralism. In this phase, Jalal's Sufistic works, such as Religious Psychology, 2003, and Islam and Pluralism, 2006, are not only divine, but also humanist-themed books. In the year 2000, Jalal ad-Din established the Indonesian Ahlul Bayt Association, IJABI, a major Shia Muslim organization with around 2.5 million members. The association has been a platform for fostering friendship and cooperation among leaders of different religions in Indonesia. Apart from his academic endeavor, Kang Jalal fought for decades for the marginalized groups, those at the bottom of the ladder. In fact, supporting the underdog was the driving force for Kang Jalal behind establishing a number of schools, which are now among the well-known educational centers across Indonesia. Around 1994, Kang Jalal initiated a program called the Spiritual Camp for his students. The students, most of which were from the upper middle class, were taken to remote areas for a week or so to develop sympathy for poor families. One of the positive impacts of the program was that these students began teaching underprivileged children free of charge. In fact, Professor Rahmat sought education equality, which he considered to be the key to having a better society. He also helped students unable to pay for school fees, but had genuine interest and enthusiasm for learning. By 1997, Kang Jalal had managed to convince his well-off friends to cover the costs of these students so they could receive an equal quality of education. Not satisfied with that, in the same year, Keng Jalal founded Mutahari and Asajodia Junior High Schools in Kikalenga, Bandung, for students and families who could not afford high-quality education. Once he said, "My dream is to see schools like Mutahari School in all corners of the country so that poor children are not cut off from education." He helped many students who are going to continue their education in the Middle East and Europe.
Republik Indonesia, tahun
1902. Jalaluddin was also a member of the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle, the PDIP, the only party he believed defended minorities. He served as the member of the People's Representative Council of Indonesia from 2014 to 2019. Jalaluddin was seated in Commission 8 of the Council, which handles religion, social affairs, and the empowerment of women, things he cared passionately about during his life. Professor Jalaluddin Rahmat is the epitome of a real religious man who believed worshipping God to be in parallel with serving his creatures. In his book, The Road to Allah, Keng Jalal wrote, "There are many ways to approach God, as many as the breath of the seekers of God. But the closest path to Allah is to make others around you happy. You serve them."
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Supporters of a prominent Saudi Arabian princess detained with her daughter in Riyadh have appealed to the British government to help secure their release. In two letters to both Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab and Commonwealth General Secretary Patricia Scotland, the princess's supporters urged them to intervene on behalf of Princess Basma bint Saud bint Abdul Aziz Al Saud and her daughter Suhud Al Sharif, arrested in Jeddah 2 years ago. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Ruth Michelson. The piece is titled "Supporters of Detained Saudi Princess Call for United Kingdom to Help Secure Release." Stay with us for more of Ruth Michelson's article. Supporters of a prominent Saudi Arabian princess detained with her daughter in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, have appealed to the British government to help secure their release. In two letters to both Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab and Commonwealth General Secretary Patricia Scotland, the princess's supporters urged them to intervene on behalf of Princess Basma bint Saud bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud and her daughter Suhud Al Sharif, arrested in Jeddah 2 years ago. They said that the princess suffers from a heart condition that requires urgent medical treatment. "We believe her life depends on her release," said the family's legal advisor, Henri Estramont and Lucy Ray, of the British human rights organization Grant Liberty, in the letter. "We are begging you to intercede. As they are citizens of the Commonwealth, we believe you have a moral obligation to fight their corner," they wrote. The pair became dual nationals of Saudi Arabia and the island of Dominica, a Commonwealth nation, in 2015, after the princess applied for their citizenship by investment program. Princess Basma, the daughter of Saudi Arabia's second king and an outspoken human rights advocate, was detained in March of 2019, along with her daughter. The pair were arrested as the princess attempted to leave Saudi Arabia for Switzerland, where she was due to have medical treatment for her heart condition. Her private plane never left Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, whilst closed-circuit television footage obtained by Spanish outlet ABC shows eight armed men waiting in the lobby of the princess's penthouse to detain her before covering the security cameras. The princess and her daughter were taken to Ha'er Prison, an infamous maximum security facility in Riyadh that houses an estimated 5,000 prisoners, including the activist Lujain Al-Hathloul, before her release this February. Al-Hathloul, who was tortured in detention, remains banned from travel outside of Saudi Arabia. You will be aware that Al-Ha'er prison is a well-known hub for torture and abuse of prisoners of conscience in Saudi Arabia, Henri Stromont and Lucy Ray wrote to Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, citing Princess Basma's ties to the United Kingdom, including her education at a school in Hertfordshire and a London-based research centre, Global United Research and Analysis. Both letters said the princess was likely to have been detained because of her past support for increased civil liberties within the Saudi Arabian Kingdom, as well as her close links to erstwhile Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. Princess Basma's supporters asked both Dominic Raab and Patricia Scotland to raise Princess Basma's case with authorities in Saudi Arabia and use every diplomatic and legal tool at your disposal to force change. We believe that the Saudi authorities are particularly sensitive to diplomatic pressure at present, and we further believe that an intervention by you could make the difference, they added. It is unclear whether the Saudi Arabian authorities will acknowledge the dual citizenship of Princess Basma or her daughter. The kingdom's citizenship laws state that Saudis cannot acquire foreign citizenship without permission, and dual nationality is not recognized under Saudi Arabian law. The Saudi Arabian mission to the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland, told the Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions last year that Princess Basma is accused of criminal offences involving attempting to travel outside of the kingdom illegally, and that her daughter, Suhud al-Sharif, was arrested for assaulting an agent whilst he was carrying out his duties, as well as cyber crimes. They added that the princess underwent a medical examination before she entered prison, and the pair were given necessary medical care whilst detained. Neither the princess nor her daughter have been officially charged with any crime, given access to a lawyer, or received a trial date. The Saudi Arabian Embassy in Washington, D.C. did not immediately respond when contacted for comment. According to Saudi Arabian law, Princess Basma and Suhud al-Sharif should already be out of prison, as no trial was scheduled within the maximum detention period of 180 days, Henri Stromont told The Guardian. To be taken seriously as a country where the rule of law prevails, they must follow their own laws. Moreover, we're still baffled by the lack of communication between the princess and her nuclear family, Stromont said, referring to long-time accusations that Princess Basma's family, that she has been denied phone calls from prison. Princess Basma is one of a number of senior Saudi royal family members who have been detained. These include Prince Ahmad bin Abdul Aziz and the king's nephew, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who were arrested last March. The pair reportedly remain under house arrest for their opposition to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, popularly known as MBS, who has consolidated power within the Saudi royal family amid the arrests of large numbers of political activists in the country. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was unexpectedly removed from the line of royal succession in 2017, when the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, replaced his cousin as next in line to the throne. The Saudi Arabian authorities are facing renewed pressure after the Biden administration declassified an intelligence report last week, which said the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, approved the operation to murder journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2018.
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense Agency Review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon. He has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found faults with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, and some of the liberals who follow and support Biden, said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come? On Friday, Amnesty International published a report expressing concern over escalating violence in the northern Ethiopia. The report said Eritrean troops fighting Tigray People's Operation Front (TPLF) rebels have killed hundreds of civilians in the city of Aksum, located in neighboring Ethiopia, in a 24-hour operation carried out in late November. The operation was said to be in response to a TPLF attack on a temporary mountain site Eritrean base. The rights group said satellite image analysis has backed up reports of indiscriminate shelling and mass looting. It also found signs of new mass graves near two of the city's churches. This is while Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, who won the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to break the 20-year post-war deadlock with Eritrea, said not a single civilian was killed during the November operation when pro-government forces captured the regional capital, Mekelle. Also, both Ethiopia and Eritrea have denied the presence of Eritrean troops in the Tigray region.
And they also claim, these two governments, that no killings took place. That's where we are right now, and it's still ongoing because conflict now between the report by Amnesty International and also the governments continuing to claim. Since the conflict, we have problems in this area of Tigray.
The Amnesty report was followed by a U.S. government document that said Ethiopia is conducting a systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing in the north of the country. The internal report obtained by the New York Times said tens of thousands of people are unaccounted for after Ethiopian officials and militia forced people out of their villages and houses. It added that Ethiopia is committing an act of ethnic cleansing by forcing people to flee, rounding them up, and relocating them to other parts of Tigray. Due to communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the humanitarian situation in the region.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Progressive anger and despair has escalated over the Biden administration's refusal thus far to make sure the $15 minimum wage increase remains in the bill as it heads to the U.S. Senate, says John Quayle, senior editor, in an article published under the heading Progressives Dismayed Over Biden-Harris' Unwillingness to Push $15 minimum wage. Stay tuned for more. after the Democrats in the House approved a far-reaching COVID-19 relief package early on Saturday, February 27th, with all but two members of the caucus on board, progressive anger and despair escalated over the Biden administration's refusal thus far to make sure the $15 minimum wage increase remains in the bill as it heads to the U.S. Senate. As journalist David Sirota, founder of the Daily Poster and former staffer for the 2020 Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, put it recently, if you were writing a Dickensian novel, it would be about millions of desperately poor people being promised a $15 starvation wage and then watching their millionaire senators tell them that a parliamentary advisor in the palace said no. While Biden and his administration have made clear they will not move to use Harris' authority as presiding officer of the Senate or to disregard or overrule the parliamentarian determination, the anger on the progressive left, both inside and outside of Congress, has only grown. Winnie Wong, political strategist and another Sanders campaign alumnus, said the choices for Biden and Harris are now quite stark and suggested the stakes are much higher than many top Democrats appear to understand or acknowledge. Recently, the national advocacy and organizing group Women's March tweeted, "The pandemic has disproportionately impacted women, low-income people, and people of color. Raising the minimum wage is COVID-19 relief. Addressing the issue on MSNBC, Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said Democrats have no choice but to muscle it through the Senate given the campaign promises made to voters leading up to last year's elections. We can't back to voters in 2 years, explained Jayapal, and say, you know, we made you a promise. You delivered us the House, the White House, and the Senate, but a parliamentarian told us that we can't do it. In a column recently, the New Republic's Osita Nowano argued that there is simply nobody but Democrats themselves to blame for failure to include the $15 minimum wage increase in the Senate's COVID-19 relief package. Not Republicans, not the Senate parliamentarian. Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and even Joe Biden are to blame for squandering their party's majority power, he wrote. According to Nowano, it has been written and said that the gambit failed because the Senate parliamentarian ruled that including the minimum wage increase would violate reconciliation rules. This is false. The Senate parliamentarian is a wholly powerless functionary who can be overruled at any time by the party holding the White House and Congress, both of which, as you might recall, are now controlled by the Democratic Party. The gambit failed because the White House and many Democrats in Congress opposed overruling the parliamentarian. As Common Dreams reported recently, a progressive coalition including One Fair Wage, Women's March, People's Action, Center for Popular Democracy, and dozens of others have sent a letter to Biden and Harris and are circulating a petition demanding that the parliamentarian guidance be disregarded so that the increase can be included in the Senate bill. As President of the Senate, Vice President Harris has the constitutional power to disregard the recommendation of the Senate parliamentarian and include this provision in COVID relief legislation, the letter states. Noting that the vast bipartisan majority of Americans support raising the wage, the groups tell Biden in their letter that he simply must rise up for the communities who turned out in record numbers to elect him and support the vice president in taking this action on behalf of his administration. While critics spent the weekend blasting the president and vice president for hiding behind the Senate rules, Novano was among those who said an alternative path is clearly possible. If only Biden would fight, one thing Biden might have to voters, he said, in any of the domestic policy speeches and public statements he's made over the past month, is that the minimum wage and other policies are more important than the Senate rules, and that the Senate rules should be changed to pass them, potentially giving Manchin and Sinema, who do not really care about raising the minimum wage but do care about being re-elected, an incentive to support raising the minimum wage and changing the Senate rules. Following the passage of the COVID-19 package in the House recently, Ben Jealous, president of the People for the American Way, applauded the approval and said now it is time for the Senate to complete the job. It's clear why the Senate must pass this bill. Families continue facing economic anxiety. Unemployment claims are skyrocketing and people are behind on rent and facing household hunger, said Jealous. Every element of this package is critically important and they must not be whittled down in the Senate. Therefore, we urge the administration and the Senate to do everything in their power to quickly pass the American Rescue Plan, including the $15 minimum wage increase to ensure Americans get the help they need. Representative Ro Khanna suggested there is no excuse for every single Democrat in the Senate not to get on board with the $15 wage that Biden vowed to pass throughout the election season last year. This issue of will there will be the votes in the Senate on final package is pretty simple, Khanna said recently. If progressives can compromise and rally around the exact package President Biden proposed, is it not reasonable to expect every elected Democrat to do that? Khanna also appeared on CNN to discuss his position. Representative Ro Khanna on a $15 minimum wage hike provision in President Biden's COVID-19 aid package, there is still the ability to rule this in and have a vote on the package. Recently, Jayal Pal repeated her message that Senate passage must follow if Democrats want to fulfill the pledges they made to the American people. First, we promised workers that we'd give them a long overdue raise. Then the House passed a $15 minimum wage, she tweeted. Now the Senate must do everything necessary to urgently deliver. It's been 12 years since we've raised the minimum wage and 30 since we've raised the federal tipped wage at Jayapal. We can't keep kicking the can down the road as millions are pushed into poverty. In a crisis like this in the U.S., working people need all the help we can provide. Let's deliver.
Inside Israel.
Israel is ever closer to another election. It would be the fourth one in 2 years. A preliminary date has been set for March 16, 2021. A majority of Israeli lawmakers voted to dissolve parliament in a preliminary reading.
Unfortunately, and I'm saying the truth, Benny Gantz reneged on the agreements between us. And this decision is dragging the state of Israel into elections. And I think it happened, and this isn't a secret, because of an internal fight in his party. He reneged because of his insistence to continue giving Nissenkorn, against the coalition agreement, to advance a dictatorship of left-wing bureaucrats. And these bureaucrats are ruining the will of the people.
This brings Israel closer to its fourth round of elections in 2 years. Disagreements over the 2020 budget have caused the latest political turmoil. The main issue is that the Israeli coalition cabinet can't really agree on anything. Israeli ministers accuse Israel's prime minister of lying and sidelining his demands, in particular, a proposed budget, the same budget that hasn't been passed. Another election means Israelis have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for it. Israel's elections are costly. They run upwards of $400 million per election. About 30% of that money, according to Channel 12, will go to party funding. Another 20% will go to party member loans. Israel has had 3 so far in less than 2 years. According to the Manufacturers Association of Israel, the latest 3 elections cost Israelis $3.8 billion. This calculation factors in the expense of election days that require businesses to close for the day. In Israel, any election day is a national holiday to facilitate voting. If businesses still open, according to the Israeli law, they need to pay their employees 200% of their normal salary for the day. The Calculation Manufacturers Association of Israel also includes party campaign budgets funded by Israel and the cost of operating the Central Elections Committee, which oversees the electoral process. Furthermore, with caretaker cabinets in place since December 2018, Israel's economic policies have been on hold, while the debt increased and costs continued. Costs incurred by the ongoing political maneuvering and ultimate stalemate that exist following the latest election results may be compounded by yet another election soon. The lack of a budget law has hurt the most vulnerable, worst of all. The lack of a state budget has left working parents, especially lower-income ones, with no immediate solutions to the problem.
You know, it's a lot of money, but I have to be frank with you and the audience. I want to say that this will bring problems and more crisis to the citizens of Israel. But it's not the main crisis in Israel. We can see now this cost of the new campaign and the election will make the crisis wider from one side and deeper from other side. It means that we are already in the crisis. And the election will bring more problems and to make this crisis wider and deeper. You know, everybody, that the election, the fourth one in less than 2 years, is out of the complicated crisis politically, economically, and the health and the corruption crisis in Israel. It's a reflex of this crisis. There is a new phenomena of this fourth election, different than the last 3 elections. In the last 3 elections, the main discussion were between the right-wing parties, Netanyahu and the Likud, and from the other side, the center and left forces and parties in, for example, Gantz and the Labour Party and the Merits and the Common List in the Arab side. But this election is not between these two forces, the right and the from one side and the center left in the other side. Now the discussion, the main fight, is between the right parties from the other side, other right parties, between the right parties together,
And this is a new phenomena. Wasn't in all the history of Israel from the first election on 1949 till now.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Philippe says, now Israeli elections coming up and have to watch all this over-recharge stuff again. Likud will win again. Benjamin says he's Israeli. The elections are not a big deal. Netanyahu is facing elections also. It's all a ploy. Yonah says, Israeli elections are almost officially back for the fourth time in 2 years. Preliminary date of March 16 set. This is the timing Blue and White wanted and not later in the spring post-vaccination that Likud wanted. Though not clear, Blue and White will do any better.
Quite clear that the Israeli economy is going to pay and is already paying a very heavy price for having a fourth election in 2 years. But what many people overlook is the moral, psychological, and the motivational damage that is being caused, because there's a large number of people from the Israeli middle class. And it doesn't really matter if it's center-left or center-right, who still believe that Israel is a Western, democratic, Zionist, normal state. And they still believe in the institutions of this state. And what they are discovering, or will discover, is that on top of the pyramid sits a man who will do everything in his ability to remain in power and will subvert the economic and political and justice system of the country. He will undermine it to achieve his goal. At the moment, Israel's debt lies at 14.5% of its GDP. Unemployment is at 20%. Poverty is at 29%. The Israelis don't need new elections at this time that will cost $400 million. What they need is good governance, and they need a budget, because there hasn't been a budget for 2020, nor for 2021. Nevertheless, elections are being held, and that is due to Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on having a one-year budget plan. Netanyahu insisted on having a one-year budget plan, although he agreed to have a two-year budget plan earlier, because he wanted to have absolute control over the situation.
Israelis are upset about this because, according to KAN, the same troublemakers and lawmakers and officials in the Israeli cabinet and Knesset who are calling for a fourth election are the ones who benefit and are in some way rewarded for such political standoffs. And now they're going to get a reward for trying to convince Israelis to pick them again using their own tax money. Many of the members in the Knesset and the cabinet have been there running for their seats since the first election out of three seemingly failed ones. Israelis have lost confidence in them. It seems that no matter how much money is spent on their campaigns and how much fiscal funding they receive courtesy of Israeli taxpayers, they can't even pass a budget that will allow Israelis and Israel in general to function. Israelis believe that this is what the regime wanted. A fourth election looms because it is the only mechanism available to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to call new elections. For Netanyahu, a fourth race place in under 2 years would have him not cede his office in November 2021 to his rival-turned-partner, Military Minister Benny Gantz. Netanyahu and Gantz have been circling each other for months. Netanyahu has been seeking to escape the clauses of his coalition agreement. Gantz has been struggling to hold him to it, and the budget has served as the main leverage in that fight. This leaves the Israeli public to be the outcast in all of this, while they bear the biggest brunt. Hence, protesters, which are at their 28th week of protests, are calling for the downfall of the regime, simply because they have had enough.
It means the mass of the citizens of Israel are the main loser. But if we take it in the between